State and local candidates had until 5 p.m. yesterday to file the paperwork they needed to run for office in Illinois. Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives filed at the last minute. She's running for governor against the incumbent from her own party.
Governor Rauner is responsible for the 32% tax increase. He failed to hold Republicans together. His proposed budget actually spent more money than the past budget by the Democrats.
Plus, the Thompson Center in Chicago is a grand civic building whose days might be numbered. A new documentary tells us why.
Does society need shining examples where you roll the dice and think big? Yes. Does society need affordable tax rates? Yes. Can you do all that at the same time? Probably not.
And how the soybean became America's new number one crop. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. It's Tuesday, and while we usually talk state politics on Monday, we wanted to wait until the deadline was up to file paperwork to run for office in Illinois. Now we know who's in and who's out. When I'm not guest hosting the 21st, I'm a statehouse reporter for public radio stations across Illinois, so you might have heard me as a guest on this segment before, but today I get to ask the questions. I'm joined now by Chris Mooney, the W. Russell Arrington Professor of State Politics at the University of Illinois Springfield. Chris, great to talk to you again.
Well, glad to be here, Brian.
And Natasha Kurecki, who covers Illinois for Politico. She also writes the Illinois Playbook, which is usually the first or second thing I read every morning. Thanks for coming on, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
So, Natasha, let's start with Governor Bruce Rauner. Before we get to the filing, sometimes I feel like we're running out of adjectives, superlatives, but it seems like we could be at the start of another horrible, no good, very bad week for our incumbent Republican governor. Yesterday, he was talking about state government when he told reporters, quote, I'm not in charge or I am not in charge. This comes, of course, less than a week after National Review put him on the cover next to the headline, the worst Republican governor in America. How are things going for Governor Rauner as he begins his, you know, formally begins his reelection campaign?
Excited. Not well. it's just been a rough couple weeks, like you said. I mean, I think we started off this morning talking about how it seemed like he had hit bottom, and then with that National Review cover, and then boom, he says something like this. It was really surprising. It came out, I think, in a little bit of frustration, going back and forth with reporters yesterday. And, you know, today he was trying to correct it a little bit, trying to back away from it. But it just does not look good, and it happens at a really bad time. It's right when Jeannie Ives is getting into the contest, you know, and she's been focusing on he has a lack of accomplishments. He has done things like signing the abortion funding bill and so forth that Republicans don't like. And then on top of it, he's saying, well, I'm basically ineffective. I'm not in charge. So there's a lot for opponents to work with there.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, you've been following Illinois government for a long time. I am not in charge is not typically something you expect the state's top executive to say as he's beginning to mount his reelection campaign.
No, we like our leaders confident, and that does not sound like confidence. It ironically reminds me of Al Haig declaring himself in charge after the Reagan assassination attempt. I mean, it's a little bit. I'm sure there are words he would prefer to not have uttered. One of the things about public officials, they're in public a lot, and they say a lot of things, and they're human beings for the most part, and occasionally something comes out of their mouth that's a little embarrassing, and I think that's what's going on here. I think the bigger issue is that he's getting this hard charge from the right. And it's getting, I mean, and we got to remember National Review is a, it's the stalwart, conservative, magazine, sort of the Atlantic Monthly of the right, I suppose. And Jeannie Ives also runs at him hard from the right. And as Natasha pointed out, I mean, what Governor has done in the last 6 months or so is done some pretty specific acts that alienate him from that portion of the Republican Party primary, including what they're going to say is he put in what she continually says is that he's signed the most liberal government payment abortion bill in the country, that we've now got a sanctuary cities bill that we never had before, and there's some issues about the trans bathroom issue. These are red meat for the right wing. And she is an excellent messenger for that because she is a very tough, she's kind of a bulldog that doesn't mind throwing some bombs. For example, in her announcement, she said something like, and I'm paraphrasing the first part of it here, that we thought we elected a conservative Republican, but in fact we elected a Ivy League university gender studies professor, which might be the worst epithet that someone from that part of the world can throw at a Republican, right?
All right, so that was a bit of a head scratcher for me. Maybe if you have to watch a little bit more Fox News and keep up with that sort of thing to have that make more sense. The Ivy League gender studies professor comment. But so, Natasha, this does segue nicely into election filing. We heard a little bit about, you know, what Representative Ives's case is going to be, attacking the governor from the right. But the governor, as we heard yesterday, and you pointed out, Natasha, that he was testy in his exchange with the media. He still wants this to be about House Speaker Madigan, right?
Right. I mean, he's invested so much into maligning Madigan. If you think about all of the things that we've seen, the documentary, you know, all of the commercials, millions of dollars in negative advertising on Madigan, they've invested in this. The Republican Party's invested in attacking Madigan, making him well-known to people so that an average Illinoisan who didn't know much about Madigan now does know about him. So that he's invested a lot in this over the last 3-4 years. So yes, he still wants, that's what he's going back to. And I think he keeps getting these questions now of like, hey, you're not the same guy you were when you were running originally. You can't say that you're, you know, not a politician. Now you have a record. So let's talk about your record. And yesterday, I'm not sure if it was frustration, if some of the stuff has gotten to him, or if it was something, a pivot where they, you know, his campaign said, look, you got to go hard, you got to really come back and attack, and it just went kind of off the rails there, because then he started attacking the media, too. You guys got to do your jobs, and, you know, talking about the mafia, you know, Madigan's like a mafia guy, and it just sounded a little bit off the rails.
Also, Chris, go ahead.
I was going to just say that he's been selling this line for quite a while and devoted many millions of dollars into making this stick, but it's a tough one because most people have no idea what's going on in the state legislature. I think he's managed to raise the visibility of the speaker among the general public, if polls can be trusted on that. But it's still, you know, the average voter looks at state government. He sees a governor. He sees this is daddy. This is mommy. This I understand. They're in charge. They don't understand the legislative process in detail. Why should they? It's a mess oftentimes. And, for those of us who have to keep an eye on it, it can give us a headache. So it's hard to get people to understand that this guy, you know, what he's doing, what is Mike Madigan doing, especially he's a guy that's very quiet. He doesn't speak a lot in public. So it's not like he's, you know, got a lot of gaffes, almost no gaffes ever come out of his mouth, right, because he's very controlled. So it's a tough one, and I think he's getting frustrated that even though they've managed to move the needle on that, it's still, you know, he is still the governor. People still hold him responsible for what's going on, for the most part, in the state. And he is doing the exact opposite of what most governors do, and that he's saying, I don't have a record. I mean, this is not my record. It's not my fault. You know, whatever kind of mess we've just gone through for the last 3 years, which was historic and painful, and we're going to be suffering for it for years to come. And that's not me. I didn't do that. Mike Madigan did it. And that's a subtle argument that it's hard to sell, and he's getting frustrated, I think, from his lack of success at it.
Well, we haven't even talked about the Democratic side of the ballot yet. Not as many surprises, or no real surprises there, I guess. J.B. Pritzker, Chris Kennedy, State Senator Daniel Biss, the more high-profile candidates who filed, as well as Madison County Regional School Superintendent Bob Diber, anti-violence activist T.O. Hardiman, physician Robert Marshall, as well as somebody named Terry Goetz, although he does not have a lieutenant governor candidate, so I don't think legally he can remain on the ballot. We also had a huge slate of people who file to run for attorney general. Chris, this has kind of become a sought-after post, particularly in the era of Trump, if you're a Democrat, right?
Yes, it's attorney generals really for a couple of decades now have been leading figures in national movements for, especially for consumer protection stuff, so tobacco settlement, things like that. You know, the attorney generals have really driven that, and they get some national press on it, and certainly within the state, it's a fantastic office. Attorney General Madigan has just demonstrated how you can go into that office, which is really sort of vaguely defined in the Constitution, and just make it whatever you want, as long as it's not the prosecutor, because it's not a prosecutor, but they, you know, what she did is she walked in and said, let's be consumer protection agency, and everybody loves a consumer protection agency, right, because you're getting, you know, checks for grandma when she got ripped off by the electric company and stuff, and the fact that she's so incredibly popular demonstrates that as attorney general, if you play your cards right, it's, as she says, very satisfying. It's also very politically has a lot of potential for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to read the names. There's 8 Democrats, 2 Republicans running for that. Natasha, I want to look a little bit further down the ballot. We've only got about 4 minutes left. There's still a lot to get through here. We had a surprise running for Secretary of State, Mike Hastings, a Democrat, filing to challenge Jesse White in the Democratic primary there. The Republicans, there was some question about whether they might even field candidates for offices like Secretary of State, Controller, and Treasurer, but they all did. What else jumped out at you, in that the remaining constitutional offices there, Natasha?
Well, one thing in the remaining constitutional offices, I think you're right about the AG's race, the controller race. You have Darlene Sanger, who was working with the governor's administration, running as a Republican against Susana Mendoza. I think Susana Mendoza has really sort of solidified her role, and she has really created herself into a foil for the governor. I think that race will be interesting to watch, and we've seen how essential it is, especially if the government goes without any money, goes without a budget. So that's something definitely to watch. I think, the Republicans just have kind of an uphill battle. They haven't really, in some of the constitutional offices, they started late. There's not a lot of name recognition, people like Jesse White's going to be, I think he gets some of the biggest winning percentages in the state of any politician. So he's a tough one to topple.
Chris, I wonder, why does it matter to people, for people who don't follow this sort of thing day in and day out, does it matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat in the Secretary of State's job, in the Controller's job, in the Treasurer's job, Chris?
Well, I can't imagine it matters to the average person on the street too much. On a day-to-day basis, they probably can't tell you what the Secretary of State does or who that person is for the most part. But it does have, those are offices that can, especially the Secretary of State's office, has a lot of impacts, direct impacts, right? I mean, before Jesse White got in there, one of the reasons he's done so well is that, they run the driver's licenses and the license plate offices, and they used to be a mess. mess. And Jim Edgar too, when he took that office over, he used to be a lot worse. So it can, and they fixed it up and they got popular, both Jesse White and Jim Edgar, because of that. So it does have direct impacts on people. Now, whether it's more of a competency issue, I think, than a Democrat or Republican issue, that's for sure. The parties, I mean, in terms of a stepping stone to, you know, who's going to be the next governor and things like that. I mean, these are important opportunities for people that want to rise to demonstrate their competence or lack thereof.
Natasha, we've only got about a minute left, but in, you know, the other 500, 600, 700 people who filed for office, anything jump out at you? Ken Duncan, Denise Rothheimer. What should we be looking for?
Well, very interesting. Ken Duncan came back. I think it's interesting. There's no opponent.
This is a state rep who famously defied Madigan and was forced out by Madigan in a rare
right.
Democratic primary. Yeah.
Right. And then in the congressional races, you know, we saw there was a lot of talk around Bobby Rush filed very late, but he did file. You ended up, despite the coronation of Chuy Garcia, you have now 11 people, I think, running for Luis Gutierrez's open spot. People put that together quickly. Michael J. Madigan, no opponent right now, despite all the talk and all the criticism from the governor. He doesn't have a primary. Neither does John.
But his counterpart, House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, does.
And exactly right. It's interesting how these things work. Durkin is very popular in his district, but Mickey Straub does have a name for himself too. So it's not going to be a cakewalk.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much more to talk about. I'm afraid we are out of time for today. Natasha Kurecki from Politico and Christopher Mooney, who is a professor of state politics at the University of Illinois Springfield. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. Drive through many parts of Illinois, and there's a good chance you'll see either cornfields or soybean fields. They're the two biggest crops in our state by far. Corn is still number one in Illinois, with soybeans a close second. According to the USDA, more than 10 million acres of soybeans were harvested in Illinois just last year. And in fact, nationally, soybeans overtook corn as the most harvested crop in the country. And yet, there's no sweet soybean festival, no soybeans football team, and you don't hear about the amber waves of soybeans in America the Beautiful. So what do we actually know about America's new number one crop? In a lot of ways, it's hidden in plain sight. McDonald's lists soy as an ingredient in more than 200 items, from fries to sauce to chocolate chips. And at the grocery store, scan nearly anything and you'll likely find terms like soy lecithin and soy flour. Might have mangled that pronunciation there. Hopefully our guests can help me out on that. Joining now to help us learn more about soybean is Austin Rinker. He's a soybean farmer in Shelby County and a member of the Illinois Soybean Association. I'm also joined by Peter Goldsmith, Associate Professor of Agricultural Economics at the University of Illinois, and William Shurtleff, with the Director of the Soy Info Center in California. Everybody, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Peter, we're going to talk about other uses for soy in a bit, but let's talk about the soy we eat first. We may not even be aware of some of it, right? What are some of the ways that soy might be processed and hidden in plain sight?
Yeah, soybean has risen to such to command the marketplace because of its versatility and its functionality for the feed manufacturing industry, as well as the food manufacturing industry. So it is the base oil for the food industry, so any product that needs oil. I mean, there are specialty oils as well, but if you want a basic standard oil, soybean, if you see vegetable oil on the label, it will be soybean oil. On the feed side, it's a number one protein source for livestock feed, which is a macronutrient critical for animal growth. And so all poultry, swine, aquaculture, dairy rations, fed cattle rations, all are based on a corn and soybean ration. So that's a lot of chickens, a lot of pigs, a lot of mm-hmm. fish, lots of cows, et cetera. So it's the base product for much of what we produce and much of what, therefore, what we eat.
So either we're eating it indirectly through feed for animals, or we're getting it directly. Let's stick with the soy we eat sort of more directly. William, I want to turn to you now. What are the most popular soy food products?
Let me step back just a second and tell you that soybeans first arrived in the Midwest in Illinois in 1851, and the next year they were spread to Iowa and Ohio. And so of all the states in the Midwest, Illinois was the first to grow soybeans. Today, there's been a lot of research about how people in Illinois like to eat soybeans best, not where they're hidden in other foods or fed indirectly to animals, but how people like them best. And the consensus, the overwhelming consensus, is that people in Illinois like to eat soybeans as green vegetable soybeans, which are called edamame. In 1937, Professor J.W. Lloyd in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Illinois sent out packets of 100 seeds to 122 Illinois gardeners with instructions for how to grow them and requested a report of their experience at the end of the season. And reading those reports is really interesting because person after person describes them as the most delicious vegetable crop that we've ever eaten. And so I think that the best way for people in Illinois to use soybeans is to use them as green vegetable soybeans. That means that you harvest them at the green state before they start to turn yellow or brown in your vegetable garden. You plant them 1 week apart to spread the harvest out over the season. You can get the seeds from two sources, so write this down, parkseed.com or burpee.com. They specialize in varieties that are the tastiest and the best yielding. They will give you instructions for how to grow the soybeans. They will give you instructions for how to eat them, but basically you just drop them into boiling water for 7 minutes, salt them lightly, and pop them gently from the pods into your mouth. That's the Japanese way of eating and the favorite way of eating in the United States. So I recommend above all for people in Illinois that they plant green vegetable soybeans in their garden and eat them as a garden crop.
All right. Well, speaking of people who plant and grow soybeans, let's bring Austin into this conversation. You grow soybeans in Shelby County. I want to ask, what are they used for?
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to join you here from the field. I actually finished up some field work here today. Here in our area, a lot of them will be processed actually into soybean meal and soy oil. So, like as previously said, a lot of soybean meal is going to go to livestock rations. Here in Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, and so feed corn, hogs, chickens, and be a good protein source for those livestock rations. And then a lot of that can be exported overseas, too, with the livestock that we have here in the United States and shipping that abroad. And then biodiesel is another major product that the oil gets utilized in and food products. And just a really versatile product with a lot of different uses.
So who grows the majority of the soybeans we eat in this state?
Farmers. We have about 42,000 farmer members here in Illinois. So. And here, just with the economics, the way it's been the last few years, a lot of farmers are kind of in a 50-50 crop rotation with corn and soybeans on their farm. So half their farm would be planted to corn, and the other half would be planted to beans. And that's kind of how we've been here probably about the last 5 years here on my operation. So it's got a lot of flexibility, like I say. I mean, it's got a lot of different uses, and it's a nice crop to grow. So,
are they pretty much everywhere in the state? And can you find soy growing?
Yeah, you'd find state soybeans growing throughout the state, and there's market access points to sell soybeans. Like I sell soybeans to my local elevator, and then I also have a processor about 30 minutes away from the farm, and we'll actually direct ship beans off the farm right to the processor, where they'll be crushed into meal and oil, and then further processed just right there. So 30 minutes up the road, and they're being processed. And kind of another neat fact with soybeans here in Illinois, we'll almost export almost 60% of the soybeans will go right out of the country from Illinois that are produced here. So overseas markets for protein is just tremendous. And China is our number one customer of soybeans.
Yeah, that's actually, you took the words right out of my mouth, because I understand that China has played a big role in the growth of soy as a commercial crop here in the United States. What are soybeans used for in China?
China has the largest hog population, the largest hog herd in the world. So they've got a growing middle class. And as that middle class grows, they want more and more animal protein. And so that soy protein will leave Illinois and go overseas to China for hog production. So, and you look at graphs and things and just how that demand's growing, and it's just tremendous. I mean, the line just goes straight up. The demand for protein is just huge over there in China.
So, William, I want to ask you, despite soy now becoming the country's new number one and number two crop, we've heard from Austin working the fields today even, but we don't think of farmers coming in off the field and serving up bowls of soybeans necessarily. In fact, the terms we use, we talk about the cornfields sometimes. Why do you think that soybeans haven't really caught on as a cultural marker in the way that corn has?
Because it's the Midwest. Your part of the country thinks about soybeans totally differently than the non-Midwest part of the country. In California, for example, which is kind of an extreme, we think of soybeans as foods. We don't feed soybeans to many animals in California, but you can find soy in literally hundreds of different items in local grocery stores. You can find it as edamame, fresh vegetable soybeans. You can find it as tofu, soy sauce, miso, soy flour. And these are the kinds of foods that we eat in California. And I would like to say that in China, the idea of feeding soybeans to animals is a new idea that was introduced to China basically by Western countries. And their approach to soybeans has always been to use them as their basic source of protein in their diet, not in the feeding to animals. And that's because China's population has always been large, and they don't have room to grow soybeans and then feed the soybeans to animals. Once that globalization has started, they have been able to import their soybeans from the United States, Brazil, Argentina, and so forth. And now they use a large percentage of their soybeans, I don't know what percent, use a large percentage of their soybeans as livestock feed. And they also use soy oil because they crush many of those soybeans in China. But for most of the history, and in fact for about 80% of the history that soybeans have been in China, they've been used almost entirely for food, except that chickens and hogs have foraged them around the houses of the farmers who grow them in China.
Hmm. Well, Peter, I want to get back to you here. I wonder, we've heard a lot about the sort of cultural significance of soy, or perhaps lack of significance, growing significance, if you will. We've heard about the economics of it. I wonder, is soy becoming more popular among farmers because of, some sort of cultural acceptance? That probably sounds like something a city slicker would say, right? Or are we talking commodity prices are getting better for soy? What's going on here?
Yeah. The Midwest and Illinois in particular is just a perfect place to grow both soybean and corn. And in recent years, and this ebbs and flows, the relative prices have changed based on the relative demand for corn and soybean, and the relative input costs for soybean and corn have changed. And farmers solve that calculus about which is more profitable in a particular year versus another year when prices both for inputs and the grain would change. But they complement each other very well in terms of disease management, soil quality, and so forth, so that some sort of rotation is always good, and the relative prices then affect whether farmers weight more towards soybean or weight more towards corn. And so right now, soybean is more preferred, but I'm sure prices will change. And in, you know, 5 years hence, we'll be seeing a shift back to more of a predominance of corn compared to soybean.
So, well, Austin, you're a young farmer, and your family has been farming for generations. Do you see more younger farmers like yourself turning to soybeans instead of corn, which has, you know, more traditionally been grown here in Illinois?
Yeah, I'm the fourth generation here on the farm. Kind of like was said earlier there in the conversation, it kind of comes down to economics for our operation.
Mm-hmm. And but so for now, at least, soy is I mean, what about this question of culture to you, right? And that this is an idea we heard
kind of during that growing season.
I'm sorry. Oh, I think we lost Austin there. Peter, let me come back to you. You know, we've talked about the cultural cachet of soy. You know, I think of, or I should say, of corn, right? We have the Corn Huskers football team. I was trying to imagine, you know, people have talked about the U of I needing a new mascot over the years. You don't husk soy. What would you be? Would be the Soy Extruders or something like that? I don't know. Will we be singing about amber waves of soy anytime?
Exactly. You're talking my language here. I love it. I've always wondered the same thing. I think, you know, the Corn Festival, the Urbana Corn Festival is wonderful, and we should start one, an Edamame Festival as well, and celebrate that. But it is, you know, it's a much newer crop than corn. So culturally, there's much less of a tradition. You know, going back the Morrill plots and so forth, corn, you know, soybean was not around at that time. So there's more of a cultural history and tradition with corn. It is not, you know, people do connect corn on the cob with the corn they see driving up I-57 and throughout the state, even though they're different types of corn. One is a feed corn and one is a wheat corn. So you don't drive by soybean fields unless maybe you're in California, which is an excellent comment about the consumption of soy for human use, which is much less common in the Midwest. When we drive through the state, we see soybean processors. We see and we think about soy as a feed ingredient. First, and so maybe that detracts from the cachet. But I'm with you 100%. I'd love to see a soybean as a mascot of Illinois, the university. It would. We just need a sponsor to step up, and we'll be on our way.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to leave this conversation there. I want to thank Peter Goldsmith, Associate Professor of Agricultural Economics at the University of Illinois, William Shurtleff, who is Director of the Soy Info Center, and joining us from the fields, Austin Rinker, who is the Shelby County soybean farmer, and he's on the board of the Illinois Soybean Association. Sorry we lost you in the fields, Austin. Coming up, we're going to have a conversation about the James R. Thompson Center in Chicago. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. In the middle of the Loop in downtown Chicago, there is an endangered building. The James R. Thompson Center is the seat of state government in Chicago, and it's become a sort of de facto second Capitol building. It's also been controversial since it opened 3 decades ago, and now the powers that be want to sell it as a one-time bump to the state's ailing finances. Our guests today do not like that idea, I think it's fair to say. Nathan Eddy is a filmmaker, and I think I can call him an architectural activist. He made a short documentary about the Thompson Center. It's called Starship Chicago. Also joining us is one of the people featured in his film. Bonnie McDonald is president of the preservation group Landmarks Illinois. Nathan, Bonnie, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nathan, what's in a name? Why is your film called Starship Chicago?
It's a headline from either the Sun-Times or the Chicago Tribune when the building landed because, you know, it just shocked everybody. And you're not supposed to do this as a creative person, typically, I think. But I usually start my projects with the title first. And so I saw this old headline, Starship Chicago, and I said, perfect. And I saw the whole film immediately. And that's how we got started.
So, Nathan, if I remember correctly, if you grew up in the Chicago area, right, you have some early memories of the Thompson Center?
No. I grew up, I'm like a seaside hamlet kid from Rhode Island.
You went to school here, I should say.
Yeah, I went to Northwestern. Yeah. And most of the people who worked on the film went to Northwestern.
So we were talking offline earlier. You said you would take people to visit the Thompson Center, though. Can you kind of describe for people who are not familiar with it, what is it like walking in through those glass doors?
It's like being on another planet all of a sudden. It is the apogee of joy and optimism in architecture. And it's also a kaleidoscopic riot of mirrors and color, and a 17-story circular atrium, which seems twice the height that it actually is. And these elevators that are going up and down, I mean, it's like being in some acid trip version of Gattaca or something. It's completely insane, and it bowls everybody over. It's one of the great moments in Chicago architectural history.
You know, and it's such an interesting space on its own, but it has elements, and this is covered in your film a little bit, it has elements that are supposed to be reminiscent of a traditional Capitol building, right? We have this French Renaissance building in Springfield, either reminiscent of or at least tweak the traditional elements of a Capitol building.
Sure, and I believe that Governor Thompson put it much more eloquently than I could in the film when he talks about it, taking this traditional dome of a Capitol building, doing it in glass, so you have these concepts of transparency, and then doing this very, what Helmut Jahn likes to call his architecture, is new synthesis. And so taking traditional architectural concepts and bringing them firmly into the 21st century. So when you see the building from the outside and you're looking down at it and it's got this sloped, truncated cylinder dome, I mean, it's, in a word, it's breathtaking. It's genius. Helmut Jahn's a genius.
So, okay, I want to bring Bonnie McDonald into the conversation. She's president of Landmarks Illinois. Bonnie, where does the Thompson Center fit into the architectural landscape of the city of Chicago? You know, geographically, chronologically, however you want to take that.
Well, sure. Geographically, this is in literally the northwest quadrant of the Loop. So for people who are often visiting, it's really in the government center of the Loop, next to the City Hall building and the Cook County Government Center, as well as the courts building. And that was very intentional. I think, as Nathan put beautifully, this is an expression of the best ideals of government. It is meant to be transparent, as we would hope our government would be, but also it's a reflection. The building is meant to reflect the City Hall and the County Government Center as a synthesis of the government entities that that are here for us as the citizens. So that's where it is physically, but I think proverbially it is the best postmodern building that we have. I'm going to put ourselves out there that we think this is a landmark in every way of postmodernism. And for those who don't follow architectural styles, that is predominantly buildings from the late 1970s until the mid-1990s, and are borrowing from other parts of architectural legacy, classical buildings, but synthesizing them in a new way, as Nathan said. So playing with the forms that we may know, a dome, the curtain wall from traditional modernism, and portraying them in a new way.
All right, so let's go over a brief history of the building here. It opens in the 1980s. Like I said earlier, I would argue it becomes the de facto seat of government in either the late 90s with Governor George Ryan, or when Governor Rod Blagojevich took over in 2003. A lot of agency heads moved up there. But that's about the time the building really began falling into disrepair. Fast forward through the administration of Governor Pat Quinn, and we arrive in 2015. Let's hear a clip from Starship Chicago.
We intend to close and sell the State of Illinois building, the James R. Thompson Center.
Illinois is in a sad state right now. Fiscally, we have a problem, a giant problem. But those aren't reasons to demolish buildings.
We're in a warehouse mentality right now. Everything is commoditized. So why do you need a building that has a civic feeling to it?
Does society need shining examples where you roll the dice and think big? Yes. Does society need affordable tax rates? Yes. Can you do all that at the same time? Probably not.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. We heard Governor Rauner wanting to sell the Thompson Center. We heard a description of how bad the state's finances are. At the end there, Crane Chicago Business columnist Greg Hines acknowledges the tension between having grand public spaces and the political preference for lower tax rates. On the 21st, we've talked a lot about Illinois' dire finances. I'm not really as interested in that conversation today. I want to talk about this tension over civic architecture. Bonnie, I wonder, what do you think about that? Is this an either lower taxes or grand public spaces proposition?
No, this is not an either or. And I think that is the first mistake that was made in the promotion of selling the building, is that the governor really promoted the idea that it must also be demolished, which I do not think the two must go together. You know, the state could sell the building and it could still be reused, which would be the most responsible from a cultural resources standpoint. This is a landmark. It's eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. But also from an environmental sustainability standpoint, you have the public investment that has gone into this building since its construction in 1985, and that should not just be thrown away into the waste bin. And I need to, Brian, you also brought up a term that we hear oftentimes, this idea of something falling into disrepair, and I just have to... I have to state
thrown into disrepair.
Fall into disrepair, that it is intentionally not maintained. And the choices that have been made by the state that have led to, first of all, the value engineering in the building, that the choice in the HVAC system, for example, which led to some of the challenges in working in the building, but also that the property has not had the kind of investment that it should have, and now it's very convenient to state that it's in it's in a state that needs a substantial amount of maintenance. We have made that choice to put it in that place.
Nathan, your film you know, I think does a great job of capturing some of the striking views of this building. There are perspectives I've never seen before. I think you must have flown a drone over it or something like that to get some of the shots looking down. That's not some a way we usually see this building. And yet your film also acknowledges this huge backlog of deferred maintenance. I think it's $100 million. I know people who work there and hate working there. There have been reports of bed bugs. And, you know, there are elements. This building has been controversial since it opened. You know, and I think Helmut even mentions in your film the salmon color scheme as being an interesting choice, and one that even Governor Thompson may not have been on board with. What is it about this building that you love, right? And by extension, why did you decide to make this polemic film arguing for its preservation?
What is it about the building that I love? Do you want me to do it alphabetically?
Well, we only have a few minutes remaining in our show, so pick a couple of highlights, I guess.
I think it's among the most spectacular buildings that I have ever seen, not only in Chicago, but in the world. I mean, I adore this building. The fact that we're even having this conversation is almost incredible to me to believe. How could this be happening? You know, it's so easy to be cynical and pessimistic these days, and people like myself and the people who have decided to join me, Governor Thompson, Helmut Jahn, Lynn Becker, Blair Kamen, Bonnie, you know, I'm so indebted to them because this means so much to me. This building means so much to me. And it's a building for the 20th century, the 21st century. It's a building for the 22nd century. People are going to be coming to this building 100 years from now and tripping over themselves in awe. That's how I feel about the building.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's obviously a passionate subject for you.
Well, and
yeah,
Brian,
go ahead, Bonnie.
Can I just say, once again, I need to commend Nate. He is certainly a person who is demonstrating the kind of love that people do have for the building. It is a place that we often hear, as you mentioned, that people either love it or hate it. But when you do explore the space and you're in this. When you're in this place, it is extraordinary. You can't walk into that atrium without feeling a sense of awe. And that should be sustained because it's the best of what we were trying to portray in our architecture. This is essentially the Beaux-Arts building 100 years from then. What I'm saying is, you know, we almost lost the Chicago Cultural Center or the Chicago Theater. This is the place of the future where we are going to be proud that we saved this building, and we can do it. I just want to say that we're exploring adaptive reuse potential, that the state can still achieve what it's trying to do at an affordable tax rate, as Greg Hines put it, selling the property, and there's the potential to put new construction on the site in a compatible way. Helmut Jahn has designed an addition that could be put onto the building and still reuse the existing place and sustain it into the future. So I think it can be a yes and.
Yeah, he's talked about putting a tower on there. So I wonder, what are our odds then of, in terms of this building in particular, and how has Chicago done in general with preserving these architectural landmarks?
If I can respond first, that I would say our dedication to our historic architecture is certainly notable, and in fact, it's legendary around the world that Chicago has one of the most incredible skylines in the entire world, and that we're getting better at preserving our historic and older buildings. We're finding ways to reuse them that are clever, and for those who are listening who might not be able to imagine what this could be, it could be so many things. From a hotel, another office building, a mixed-use building. I've had a suggestion of a casino. We do have those in the real estate world that are asking us how they can get into the building and look at the property to start doing some adaptive reuse studies. And so we're waiting for the state to give us the green light to start that RFP process so we can begin going in and doing the needed real estate analysis from a numbers standpoint to understand how how we can make a reuse scenario work. Until they allow us to do that, we're dreaming. And if I'm thinking about dreaming, I'm going to turn it over to Nate, because I think he is a person who can see the vision for this building in the future.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid we're running out of time, Nathan. I do want to say, in wrapping up, I did really enjoy the film, and congratulations on it. People should watch it. Whatever you think of the Thompson Center and its preservation, it's certainly an entertaining way to spend 15, 16 minutes. So, Nathan and Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
Bonnie McDonald is the president of Landmarks Illinois. Nathan Eddy is a filmmaker. If you want to see his short documentary, Starship Chicago, we'll tweet out a link and put it on our website, 21stshow.org. If you want to see the Thompson Center itself, head to Chicago's Loop. The Blue Line will take you right there, or just look for the giant starship. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is on our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.